PRN, the Progressive Radio Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning. You're listening to Bhavani on IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I'm with you every Thursday morning at 10 a.m., and I have a great show planned for you today. My guest will be Jonathan Setonarski. He is the president and CEO of the Natural Gourmet Institute, and he'll be coming on in just a little bit. But first, I want to share with you some great events going on in the area, some things in the news that you should know about, and, of course, my weekly recipe. So first, I just want to make you all aware that this week, President Obama passed into law the Monsanto bill that actually it's a GMO labeling bill that preempts all of the state laws. Actually, it's only Vermont so far that was up and running, but the Vermont law that went into effect July 1st is now void and no longer good because this new law that went into effect preempts all state laws, and it is a GMO labeling law that will just put a code or an 800 number on a package so that someone can scan it or call in to find out if there's GMOs in the product. And it is really not what the people wanted. Over 90% of Americans polled want GMO labeling, and this is a slap in our face. And it just goes to show you when corporations like Monsanto pour millions of dollars in, along with the Grocery Manufacturers Association, pour millions of dollars into lobbying our elected officials that are elected by us, they win. And it is so frustrating. We've done petitions. I mean, hundreds of thousands of people have signed petitions to turn this around. But we're not going to give up. We're going to try to reverse this law. So, of course, there's petitions to sign. There's the phone number of the White House on my website. And I ask everybody to please call the White House. If we can bombard them with phone calls, they can feel the upsetness of the American people. But we need to do it. We really need to take that action and let them know that we're really upset about this. It's just not okay. And we have to fight back. So anyway, there's a petition on my website to please do that. Also, I want to let you know that this week in Australia is a meat-free week, and IE Green is encouraging anybody who would like to participate in a meat-free week to do so any week you want, whether it's this week or another week. But give it a try. Go vegetarian for a week, go vegan for a week. Check it out. See how you feel. See how your pocket feels. It will be a little lighter. And you know, you'll be doing good for yourself and for the planet, so check that out. And also, there's a petition to tell Congress not to go back on the healthy school lunches. There's a lot of pressure in government to reverse the improvements that we have made over the last 8 years in the school lunch program. And we really need to put our kids up front and center and give them healthy food so that they can learn what they need to learn in school. So please sign that petition as well. Some fun things are going on in and around the city. Tomorrow, actually, Grown on Long Island Day is a Long Island event that has become an annual event. It takes place at the Cornell Cooperative Extension County Farm. You can just Google Grown on Long Island Day to find out more about it and what will be there. But I can tell you there's a huge farmer's market there selling local food and local wine. And then for the kids, there's Rag and Rides and farm animals. So it's a fun, free event. So check that out. August 7th through Farms and Fields, Quail Hill Farm in Amagansett is honoring some people who have been, you know, really working hard in the food movement out on Long Island, and that is Sunday, August 7th at 4 o'clock. You can go onto the Quail Hill Farm website to find that or Google through Farms and Fields. But, of course, all these things I have listed on my website also. Coming up next weekend, the NOFA Summer Conference. I've been talking about that a lot. NOFA is the Northeast Organic Farmers Association, and they have a winter conference that's always up in Saratoga Springs. Actually, that's NOFA New York. But the summer conference is all the regional NOFAs, so it's the whole Northeast. So Massachusetts, Vermont, Rhode Island, and New York, we're all there, Connecticut, up at UMass and Amherst. And it's a great weekend of learning and building in community and inspiration, and there's entertainment, of course. So it's really a fun weekend. If you can get away, it's worth it. August 13th is the New York City African Food Festival. Tuesday, August 16th is another cooking class that I will be hosting here at the IE Green Homestead. It's a Thai cooking class. It's vegan and it's gluten-free. We just had a Mediterranean one this week. That was great. So if you're, you know, wanting to experiment with more vegan cooking, this is a great way to do it. It's a really nice night out. It's a nice meal. We harvest the vegetables right from the on-site local organic garden, and it's really fun. So you can sign up from that on my website as well. August 19th is the 5th annual Food Truck Derby. That takes place at the Hayground School out in Bridgehampton. So you can find out more about that. There's so many great things going on. Gala in the Garden, that's sponsored by Slow Food East End. That's coming up September 10th. So anyway, check my website for more events. There's so many great ones going on. But I want to share my recipes with you. And this week I'm actually sharing two recipes because they're very similar. And they whip up so quickly, and I've been giving samples of them out at the farmer's market, and people have been asking for the recipes. So one is a radish green pate, and one is a beet green pate or pesto. And, you know, these are parts of the vegetables that traditionally we used to just throw away. I used to just, you know, get my radishes, rip off the tops, put them in the compost, and use the radishes, never giving the radish greens a second thought. And I did the same with my beets. And now I'm discovering the deliciousness of the beet greens and the nutritional value, and also wanting to reduce food waste. So for all those reasons, this is a great recipe. You can, of course, use any of these greens in salads or stir fries, just like you would any greens like kale or Swiss chard. But these pâtés are really wonderful. Now, I steam them first. Let's do the radish green pâté first, because I play with them, and they're just a little different, and I welcome you to play with them. Most of my recipes are very flexible. You can adjust them for your tastes, and that's something that I always say is when you're the chef, when you're the one in the kitchen, you get to make the choices. You know what you like, you know what you don't like, and so you can adjust things for your taste. So I'm going to start with the radish green pate using 1 cup of steamed radish greens, 1/2 cup of walnuts, 4 cloves of garlic, 1/2 cup of cilantro, and you press it down before measuring it. Really get 1/2 cup in there. 1/2 cup of red onions chopped, 1/2 cup of celery chopped, and you just chop it before measuring it so you can get an accurate measurement. 1/2 teaspoon salt, 1/4 teaspoon pepper, 1/4 cup of olive oil, 1 teaspoon of pomegranate molasses, and 1 tablespoon of nutritional yeast. So I steamed the radish tops first for about 5 minutes and then let them cool, or just run them under cold water really fast to cool them down, and then squeeze all the water out of it and put it into, measure it so that you have 1 cup, and then put it into the food processor. And you're going to add into the food processor the garlic, the onions, the cilantro, the celery, and pulsate that until it really blends up really nicely, until it's smooth. And then you're going to slowly add the olive oil while the food processor is running. Then add the molasses and the nutritional yeast and the salt and pepper to taste. And then taste it and see how you like it. You can add cumin to this if you'd like. You can add cardamom. There's lots of different herbs that you can add to it. You can also, of course, add parsley instead of cilantro. I know lots of my listeners don't like cilantro. You can substitute parsley. Also arugula. You can do this with arugula. But serve it with some pita chips or crudité or some gluten-free crackers, whatever you like. And it's just delicious. The color is bright green and vibrant, and it's just delicious. So let me know how you like that after you make it. And then there's also a beet green pate or pesto. And for this, I'm steaming a cup of the beet green tops, a quarter cup of cilantro. This one I put 1 cup of walnuts in, so it's a little nuttier. 4 cloves of garlic, 1/2 teaspoon salt, 2 scallions, 1/8 teaspoon cayenne pepper, 1/4 teaspoon turmeric, 1/4 teaspoon of Chinese 5-spice, 1/4 teaspoon of cumin, and 2 tablespoons olive oil. So you can see that in this recipe I'm using a little less oil but a little more of the nuts, which has some oil in it too. So you're going to steam the beets again, let them cool, squeeze out the water, and put it into the food processor. Add the scallions and cilantro along with all the other ingredients except for the olive oil, and pulsate that until it's smooth, then slowly add the olive oil and adjust the spices to your taste. And that's it. So you can see they come together so fast. They're so delicious, and I encourage you all to experiment with the greens that you normally don't eat. I have shared this before, but I just want to mention a few weeks ago when I was at the Feeding the 5,000 event in the city at Union Square, a demo that they did was using the tops of leeks. That's another part that I used to always throw out, and it always seems so wasteful. Of course, if I was making stock, I could use it in stock, but leek greens, they actually boiled them up. First, they cut them into strips, boiled them up, and used them as pasta, and I thought that was a brilliant idea. So any way that you can try to reduce your food waste, we're game. So if you come up with any great ideas, please share them with us. And now it's my pleasure to introduce my guest. Jonathan Setnarski is the new president and CEO of the Natural Gourmet Institute in New York City. The school was founded in 1977 by Anne Marie Colburn, and it actually started mostly as a macrobiotic school. And the school teaches both aspiring chefs and recreational cooks to make the connection between food and health, and they offer instruction in both essential cooking techniques, principles of nutrition, methods for sourcing sustainable ingredients, and also the culinary business practices. So Jonathan has over 25 years' experience in creating innovative, high-performing businesses in both the private and corporate sectors, and he brings a lot of that experience, or all of that experience, to running the Natural Gourmet Institute. So Jonathan, are you with me?
I am. Good morning, Bhavani.
Good morning. Thanks for joining me.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's a pleasure.
Great. So, you know, I mentioned that Anne Marie Colburn started the school back in 1977, and it started primarily as a macrobiotic school. Can you tell us about the Natural Gourmet Institute now, and how does it differ? You know, when did it change from a macrobiotic school to just a natural food school, and how does it differ from most traditional culinary schools?
Oh, certainly, I would love to. And actually, before we get started, I was listening to your recipes, and they sound amazing and right out of what we would be talking about at the school. For years, we've been proponents of root to frond, meaning that all edible parts of vegetables can be used and they can be converted and transformed into these savory, wonderful, nourishing dishes. So I love the recipes, and I can't wait to try them myself.
Oh, good.
They're absolutely really.
They've been great. You know, we table at the farmer's market just to promote slow food. When I say we, I'm promoting slow food. We have a local chapter here. And, you know, to bring people over, we always either put out hummus or, you know, some sort of dip. And I've been making these since my garden is coming. You know, I'm harvesting so many beets and radishes out of my garden. I have all these tops. So I've just been whipping up this pate every morning before going to the market. And it's been great. People are loving it.
That's wonderful. Yes, we love it too. So, I mean, to answer your question, and you did give a beautiful introduction, but Dr. Colburn founded the Natural Gourmet Institute in 1977, and it actually started out of her kitchen in her apartment on the Upper West Side. And she had been on an interesting kind of self journey about food and the relationship between food and her own health and well-being, and really started to think about that the world would probably benefit from this knowledge. Because if you remember in the 70s and certainly through the 80s and 90s, we were at the height of what people are now calling the industrial food movement. So yeah, I like to say, think kind of processed foods. But it was also the advent of the microwave and all, you know, packaged foods and frozen dinners and ease and convenience, which started probably nobly in terms of making more time available to individuals to pursue other things. But really, as we now are all learning in terms of the processing and the artificiality of it all, is really so detrimental, I think, to people's personal health. And Anne-Marie was one of the very first to kind of stick her head up and say, like, hey, what's going on here? You know, this is something that isn't quite right, because, you know, humans and our relationship to food and the world around us and community are very, very important, and we're removing a critical link, and I don't think this is good for health. And, you know, as you can imagine, a lot of people said, like, hey, you know, you're crazy, you know, get with technology, get with the modern world. And she held by her guns and, you know, really kind of began to cultivate a loyal, interesting following of people, so much so that we moved to our current location in Flatiron District in the early 80s, where we opened up the school and really kind of began to formalize and expand upon not only a microbiotics beginning, but then also kind of looking to incorporate other things. So we philosophically look at our educational values, which are very different, I think, from conventional schools in terms of this balance of science, intuition, and theory, meaning that, you know, food is everything, and it often always starts with food. And if we understand, you know, our connection to it, you can actually live more healthy, meaningful, and robust lives. So, you know, as the school evolved, she really brought in an incredible amount of different views, from Ayurveda to macrobiotics to, you know, we looked at, you know, from veganism to just vegetarianism to the use of animal proteins. And all of these things came together and formulated what we now believe to be a very unique and different curriculum from any other school. We're quite proud of the fact that, you know, we are 80% plant-based. So no other culinary school actually has such a plant-based agenda. And we are at the forefront of now what's happening with this plant-forward movement. So we have been here from all along. I mean, we like to make a joke that, you know, we were talking about kale and quinoa and community before anyone else even knew what it was. So that is one of our very, very big distinctions. And also, as we evolved the school, we really wanted to make sure that we brought in a health-supportive perspective. So Anne-Marie was very, very interested and concerned about that direct relationship in terms of what you eat directly impacts how you feel and can experience life around you. So we bring that discipline into our chefs in training, and they go off to kind of promote that, you know, one person at a time to grow the perspective and views of, you know, how you eat matters. And as we now enter this better food or real food movement, which is returning for the 21st century, we find ourselves right at the center of it and enjoying that position very much.
Mm-hmm. And I would assume that you also then pay attention to the sourcing of the food. Like, you know, I always talk to my audience about, you know, all broccolis are not created equal. You know, whether you get it at the farmer's market and you know its source, or whether you're just getting a wholesaler dropping off a case of broccoli that was grown who knows where, you know, in a conventional method.
Sourcing actually, we have a view. So the school, and thank you for bringing that up, because we have 7 guiding principles that kind of drive how we think about, you know, food and how we perform not only the school, but then also how people should think about it for themselves. And they are that food should be whole and taken in its complete parts, right? So it's similar to what we were just talking about with Route de France, that it should be seasonal, local, that food should, you know, respect and understand the traditions from which you've come, that it should be balanced, meaning that, you know, extreme diets are never good for you. So make sure your plate is complete, you know, with the right fats and carbs and proteins, et cetera. It should be fresh. And then, of course, it needs to be delicious, because if it's not, then who wants to eat it? But when we source for the school, more than 20% of our produce is acquired during certainly the summer and the fall from right next door to us in the Union Square Green Market in New York City. And we have relationships with, you know, wonderful New York farming and distributors all across the region. So we're very, very concerned about where food comes from. And even if there is, you know, if people are thinking about animal proteins, because we understand that kind of people have reasons for why they choose the diets that they choose. But if people are thinking about animal proteins, that they should make an effort to source it from a local pasture raised, sustainable, and make sure that the animals are humanely raised. So we do put these very stringent disciplines in place because it really does matter.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So was that all seven? I was writing them down. I think I missed some. Can you say what the seven guiding principles are again?
Whole, seasonal, local, traditional, balanced, fresh, and lastly and most importantly, delicious.
Okay, thanks. Great. So so what kind of students do you commonly see in your chef training program?
And I think where we are also, I think, sometimes unique to these conventional or traditional cooking schools is that we attract a wide range of students. And one of the things that I most love about what we do is the type of person who comes into the Natural Gourmet Institute, whether they're a recreational or food enthusiast type of user, or they really want a career as a professional chef. So we find that we have people who have had either profound experiences with food and food and healing, either with themselves or with a family member, a loved one, a friend, and they want to learn more about that connection between food and health so they can either bring it into their homes or their communities with which they live in. We also have a lot of people who are traditionally, you know, either vegan or vegetarian, who are environmentally kind of forward, who are thinking about kind of a plant-based kind of a diet and lifestyle, and they want to be associated with that community, and they're learning how to prepare foods that are really driven around there. But most interestingly is that we have a lot of what we call the career changers. So we have people who come into the school who are from all walks of life, that I might be in finance, I might be in retail, fashion, you name it, and they really find that they are looking for something different or meaningful for them in a way that they don't experience today. And they've made a connection about food, and they want to be a part about food and community and table. And they end up kind of enrolling in our school. So it is exciting to see people take their passions, come into the school, and then turn them into new careers.
Mm-hmm. I've been really happy to see the Natural Gourmet Institute partnering often on events with Slow Food New York City.
We love Slow Foods and the work that they do, you know, certainly around the region.
Right. And, you know, up at the Culinary Institute of New York, they barely even had a slow food awareness. I mean, they now are starting to get it, but I know the person who started the first slow food chapter up at the Natural Gourmet, and there's not that much talk, even now, with so much health and food sourcing and awareness in the news. My understanding is there's not enough of that at the traditional cooking schools, that they're not paying attention to sourcing and healthy, and you know, it's still so much of it is still, you know, teaching people how to cook for, you know, big hotels or cruise ships or whatever. That's discouraging, and so it's so wonderful to know that there is a school that does pay so much attention to, you know, what I consider so important. And
yes, thank you. We do as well.
Yeah. So what are most of the people, you know, that are coming through your training program, what are their goals after graduation? Are most of them hoping to get a job in a restaurant, or are most of them wanting to start their own thing, or they're looking to be private chefs? What kind of trends do you see?
We see students who end up going off into probably three or four kind of major categories. So we do have people who traditionally want to track in a restaurant kind of experience. So either they have aspirations to open their own restaurant. You know, some of our graduates, like most recently on people's mind, is like Chloe Cassarelli, who has taken over fast casual dining with her vegan restaurant chain called By Chloe. are certainly one of the pioneers in the space, Amanda Cohen, who owns the popular restaurant in the East Village called Dirt Candy. So, you know, we have those kinds of students who really go on to say, like, you know, I want to be in the space and I want to be a voice in certainly plant-based kind of restaurateur, and they want to elevate vegetarian and vegan cuisine in a way that people haven't thought about it before. You then have a group of people who are interested in media. So I want to go on to be a blogger. I'm going to write best-selling cookbooks. I'm going to really try to impact and raise awareness to individuals, but not in a traditional kitchen. We have people who become private chefs, and a lot, because we have a health supportive orientation, a lot of our private chefs go on to want to help, you know, they become hired by people who have illnesses. So they become chefs who are cooking for people who have various illnesses and need to kind of have more nutrient-dense kind of meals. So we love those, the health coaches and the private chefs who focus on kind of food and healing. And then lastly, we do have a large, wonderful group of people who go on to food justice advocacy, who take the knowledge that they learn, because when we talk about our sustainable sourcing, our basic quality ingredients, when we think about kind of how we approach our connection to the planet, the environment, to individuals and community through food and the preparation of food, they want to go off and kind of take that knowledge and really kind of help communities thrive and grow. So it's very exciting to see that, you know, our school is, you know, people branch off to a lot of different, you know, avenues instead of just the traditional, I'm going to go work on a hotel or a cruise ship.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, I've eaten that Dirt Candy many times. Amanda Cohen actually was a guest on my show a couple of years ago. And I have so much fun when I go there. It's really, you know, what I love is the playfulness of the food. You know, she really takes it not just delicious and beautiful presentation, but fun. You know, she wants to have every, you know, all different textures in each bite, and you know, cauliflower in every single kind of way you could imagine, whether it's pureed or fried or crunchies, or, you know, it's just so, it's really,
it's
very creative.
She's wonderful. And she actually graciously serves on my advisory board for the school. So she's able to kind of make sure that we connect, and she connects us to what's going on, and certainly in the space that she's in. And she's always joked that most of her kitchen is staffed by the Natural Gourmet Institute grads. So we love that as well.
Right, right. So your one-year anniversary is just about coming up next month. What originally drew you to this job? Because you're not a chef, per se, right? Your food is not in your... Right.
And I can't believe, Bhavani, that it's almost been a year, and I still sometimes, you know, pinch myself that I've been able to kind of find myself in this wonderful experience. And you know, hands down, I think this has been the most rewarding and exciting post that I've ever held. And I'm kind of, we joke that I'm a techie who's gone foodie. So in my past, I've run kind of and set up big businesses for large kind of multinational and global kind of brands, like household names. And, you know, I reached a point in my career that I was like, I'm not sure that this is the direction I want to take forward. And I really want to do something that I believe can have greater impact and a positive impact to the world around me. And then also to people, communities. And I want to feel that I'm doing something bigger than myself, if you were. And I was doing some work helping a nonprofit in Brooklyn, setting up kind of a board structure for a nonprofit that was doing a teaching farm associated to one of the high schools out there. And I met an alumni who told me that the school was looking for a new president and CEO. And I looked at the school and I read, and I researched Anne Marie, and then I met with the board, and it just ended up being this wonderful fit in terms of taking my years of, you know, big business, if you will, and then turning it into something that we could help kind of elevate the school and make sure that our message is getting out to so many more people than it was today. And it has just been, you know, talk about never looking back type of thing. I'm so excited about what we do. I think that the school is certainly one of the most engaging, progressive, and authentic places that I've ever been associated with. You know, we're at the center of the better food movement, and we're helping shape direction of what it means to eat healthfully. So I'm really loving what it is, and I find that it's a lot of fun to actually take these non-traditional culinary experiences and apply them in ways that are helping kind of elevate kind of what we're trying to do and magnify and amplify the good works that have to happen. So I just can't believe it. I'm energized from the minute I start the day and to the minute I put my head on the pillow, and it even sounds like it now as I'm talking to you, you know?
Well, you know, you say you weren't a foodie, but were you a foodie as far as in your own passion? Like, were you already interested in eating well, and were you doing that, or is this a complete 180-degree turnaround for you?
I was already on my own personal journey with my relationship with food, and as you can imagine, or some of your listeners and you, but when I worked for some big corporates, I spent an awful lot of time in airplanes, and I was always, you know, that typical harried business executive traveler, and I was eating whatever was put in front of me, and I was never I was never giving a thought to what was going inside, and I realized, I was perpetually tired and run down, and I started thinking about what was going on and why was I feeling this way, because I have good health, and I started taking my own stock on my diet and what mattered, and so I was on this journey concurrently, and I was already on my journey. I am predominantly vegetarian, but I was on this journey to become vegetarian. And when I met the school, I was like, wow, this can't be real. And when since I've been there for a year, I further modified my diet. And I have to say that, I am transformed in the way I feel, and I enjoy cooking differently, and I try new things, and I've changed how I approach ingredients and ingredient combinations and healthful options. And I read labels, back to the discussion you were having before I joined you, and I read labels, and and it makes me even more passionate about making sure that there's awareness for everyone about eat real, and eat clean, and if you don't know what that means, let us at the school help you.
Right. Well, this is a good moment, I think, for us to take a couple-minute break, and when we come back, I'd like to hear how you're taking some of your past experience working in businesses and corporations and how you are using that to elevate the school and bring it more into the forefront with other universities or corporations or whatever. So everyone
Wonderful. Listening,
don't go anywhere. I'm talking with Jonathan Setnarski from the Natural Gourmet Institute, and you're listening to Bhavani at IE Green, and we'll be right back.
Stay tuned for the best information on health and nutrition, current events, economics, the environment, and more on PRN, the Progressive Radio Network.
I'm Eric Davis, and I want to invite you to join me for Expanding Mind, a show that features conversations about the cultures of consciousness, magic, meditation, neuroscience, religion, technology, psychedelics, weird media. Expanding Mind is devoted to changing your perspective without insulting your intelligence. Tune into the Progressive Radio Network every Thursday at 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And check out the archive page for Expanding Mind on PRN.fm. And remember, keep your minds open.
All right, so I was back in high school, and we were in biology class. We were learning about dissecting frogs. And I think to myself, hey, I'm a journalist. Why can't I dissect the news? And so I started doing it. And I have the newsdissector.net blog, and I have News Dissector Radio here on the Progressive Radio Network every Thursday from 5 to 6 p.m. I'm Danny Schechter, your News Dissector. Join me here. PRN, the Progressive Radio Network, is moving forward, and we hope you are coming with us.
Stay tuned for more news you can use on PRN, the Progressive Radio Network.
Hello, everybody, And welcome back. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And my guest today is Jonathan Setnarski from the Natural Gourmet Institute. Hi, Jonathan. You with me?
Yes, I am.
Great. So, you know, just before the break, I was talking to you about some of your past experiences, and I was curious as to how working in the more traditional corporate business world, how that is informing the work you're now able to do at the Natural Gourmet Institute.
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think, you know, certainly when you look at the current world around us and some of our current conversations, and there's often kind of an experience portrayed about, whoa, big corporates, and here's all the negatives, I think, associated with it. But one of the more interesting perspectives is that there's also a lot of positives associated with being a part of big corporates. There's disciplines, and there are rigors, and there's thoughtfulness that goes into building strategies and communication and developing programs and how you put infrastructure in place that can enable successful, talented people like our chef instructors be successful. So taking all of these, you know, more than 25 years of this kind of executive experience and then bringing it down to a wonderful educational experience and a smaller company with which to kind of help it kind of get the solid platform to make available, you know, space for our instructors to innovate and be creative and educate has been it's been a really wonderful experience. I've learned a lot from, you know, looking at the world through the eyes of our students and our chef instructors. And I like to believe that they're learning a bit about the rigors that's required to run a successful business and to know what it takes to kind of get, you know, what you need to grow and expand and deliver. So that's been a lot of fun. And along that is that just by the very nature of the types of jobs that I used to hold and do, the connections that I have with different institutions and certainly when you're thinking about advising larger institutions, they have a very unique language. And, you know, so when you're talking to a CFO or a chief operating officer or a head of marketing, you know, their pressures from shareholders or otherwise are very, very, you know, they're very real for them. And so being able to speak their language to help them understand the importance of, you know, if we're talking with a hospital or say a university as an example, to help those people who have real pressures to deliver savings and value and shareholder experiences, and then help them introduce how if you use real food, if you have a more plant-based orientation, if you think about the connection between food and healing and wellness, and, you know, help them understand how to translate that into their language, it is opening doors for the school to help, you know, advise and kind of add impact into things that desperately need attention. So sometimes, you know, if you just have an advocate voice, you may not get the traction you need to deal with a boardroom. So if I now take my boardroom experience and help amplify the advocacy perspective, you know, we find that we're having some much more interesting conversations. And one of the works that we're doing at the school, which is just about kind of, you know, creating space for people to do wonderful things, is that my team has been working with a major New York City hospital over the past year, and we do a program which we called Hands-On Healing Kitchens. And basically what that is that we look to help educate cancer survivors and their caregivers on how to prepare nutrient-dense meals to aid with recovery. So, you know, I would be remiss if I didn't state the fact that this is the work of wonderful people who are on staff at the Natural Gourmet Institute. But it's great to be able to take those experiences and then I can amplify them to share that message with other institutions who have, you know, maybe scale and size, but translate it into their language so they would be open and receptive to the conversation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, it seems like you'd be in a good place to, you know, I don't know if Natural Gourmet wants to do this, but to actually go in and try to revamp many of the institutional kitchens that are in hospitals that are putting out food that makes people sick rather than food that makes people healthy.
We are very interested in this and have been working on kind of launching a advisory services aspect. So really outside of the educational core of our business, but really kind of beginning to look to say, like, we have all this almost 40 years of knowledge and expertise and 2,600 chef graduates in over 45 countries who are, you know, bringing this idea of healthful, natural chef kind of cuisine and cooking to people in their communities. So why can't we help these larger institutions do the same? So we've been in lots of interesting conversations with lots of interesting institutions who don't know sometimes how to get started, you know, or they're under such tremendous pressures, financial and otherwise, to help them maybe learn how to get started in a way that is safe and contained and able. So, you know, big business, whether that's hospitals or educational centers or even big corporates, it's not that they're completely, turned off to the idea that we, all of us, need to be on this journey of returning to kind of real and natural and kind of good for individuals. Sometimes the machine's been running so long that, you know, how do you get started? So, you know, mm-hmm. we've been delighted by having this ability to kind of help. Can we help influence change in our little piece of the puzzle?
Yeah, that would be so wonderful, because we know that it needs to happen. I mean, you know, some hospitals now, you know, they might have like a little kiosk or a little cafe in there that's separate from the cafeteria that might have some healthier options. But in general, you still go down to the basement cafeteria of any hospital, and it's, you know, the stuff sitting in the steam table that, you know, does not look like it was fresh ever.
Exactly. I mean, interesting thing about hospitals, I mean, I'm not a chief experience officer, but, you know, the ones who we do speak to, you know, as hospitals have privatized and as they become under, you know, sometimes privatization is not a bad thing because they are under pressure now. So, you know, consumers or patients, you know, often have the ability to make a choice. And the two biggest things that patients are saying about from a customer experience perspective is that they are so upset about the noise and food. So mm-hmm. if you're now a consumer and you're telling your provider the fact that, like, you know, I might have a choice to choose hospitals, then that's driving change, right? So as individuals, we do have the power to help influence the right kind of changes and put nutritious and healthful and healing foods on plates versus, you know, just whatever they're producing today in a very one-off kind of thing, like, oh, you have a certain disease and we have to restrict sodium. It's not taking the whole into account. So I think the changes will come. And I think that as individuals, we can certainly weigh in on it by saying that, you know, we just, if you're taking our money, you know, we expect a certain degree of kind of you know, experience as a result mm-hmm. of that. So I think that's good news for the future.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, with business, it always comes down to dollars and cents. Have you been able to demonstrate that they can do a primarily plant-based or a healthy cafeteria for a similar cost, or is it double the amount? You know, because that's what you always hear. Oh, it's way too expensive. We can't afford it. Has anyone played with those numbers?
We're very early. Oh yeah, we're very early days into it, Bhavani. But we do have, you know, we have a couple chief experience officers who've been very, very progressive that have been able to show by converting, you know, cafeterias to become more healthful with healthful choices, they can actually become self-sustainable in terms of, you know, from a dollar and cents perspective, that they can fund themselves and maybe fund other programs. And when you look at kind of cost per unit, which, of course, if I'm a chief financial officer, I'm interested in that number. So they've been able to show this kind of savings. And what we can show is the fact that, you know, if you can think about how you're sourcing and source responsibly and think about scale and volume and stuff like that, that you might be able to have a savings. But, you know, we're still a little bit away. Like, I'm looking forward to the day that when we're producing papers on the fact that, like, here's some models that you can follow to get there. But some of the biggest challenges, I think, today is that, you know, as a line item, if I'm a big hospital and I'm under all this pressure and food is a line item that's typically not covered by the cost of being in the hospital, I have all these institutional contracts because I'm managing costs all over the place, and they're hard to unravel, and how do I do it? And so there's a 1-2 punch, I think, that has to happen where, you know, can the providers of these big food service providers, how do you help them make the journey to real and whole and seasonal, and help them understand if they can change their economic model it's mm-hmm. a benefit for everyone. So that's I think, a lot of work that goes in that better food movement. There's, I think, a long value chain of people who need to be involved in that conversation. What we're hoping to do at the Natural Gourmet Institute is teach a little bit about the how. So what recipes could you use? What kind of kitchen training do you need, et cetera? So, you know, hopefully when we talk again, we'll have some good stories to share.
Yeah. Well, it's very exciting. There's great potential. So I'm looking forward to watching how it goes. But going back to the school and the courses that people can take at your school, I know you have a couple different, you have like chef training, and then you also have certificate programs. Can you share with us what those differences are and what you offer for potential students?
Absolutely. So the school has two different sides of it. The first is very much a vocational training program, which is what we refer to the chef's training program. And this is where I mentioned before that we have, over our history, have graduated over 2,600, you know, qualified chefs. We're licensed by the state of New York. We are nationally accredited, which means that, you know, we get reviewed for best in practice standards, that we are, you know, we have a wonderful curriculum that has impact, and we graduate students who have all the requisite skills required to go into professional kitchens or otherwise. Then we have a side of our business, which is what we lovingly refer to as the institute side of what we do. And that's for recreational, parties or people who just, I want to learn more about gut inflammation. I want to learn more about, you know, potentially learning how to bake a vegan cupcake. I want to learn about knife skills, or I want to learn about bleed zone diets. And, so I'm not going to become a chef, and I don't need to be professionally trained, but I'm interested in knowing more about kind of how to do something for my own personal use. So we run an array of public class programming that allows students to come in to have these one-off experiences. We do, so in addition, so the chef's training program, if I can step back for a second, it is a 619-hour program. So you actually get a diploma when you graduate, and within those 619 hours, you learn basic kitchen techniques. So you learn actually how to move around a professional kitchen, how to use knife, with French and Japanese, like, cooking techniques and cutting techniques. You learn how to source quality ingredients. You're learning how to bake. You're learning how to do, prepare desserts. You're learning how to cost, all the business side of it. So it is a full bottoms-up training. The differences,
but do you do meat? Like, do they also do butchering?
We do. So butchering, less so much, but we do have, because we are licensed by the state of New York, it's my obligation to our students in, you know, our chefs in training, that we give them all of the knowledge that they need in order to be successful in any kitchen they may choose to work in. So, and our school is, we take the position of that, although we are more plant-based, in favor of a plant-based, or at least a plant-heavy plate, that, you know, in some cases, animal protein may be an important aspect of one's diet. So the students need to learn how to, as I mentioned earlier, how to make sure that if you are using animal proteins, you know, where do you source it from? How is the animal treated? What do you look for in terms of sustainability, in terms of use of antibiotics, et cetera? And then they learn how to prepare dishes that will complement a plant-heavy sort of plate. So, you know, we do have, we although we're not a vegan school, we attract enormous amount of vegans because we're a nice haven, because we do spend most of our time in the realm of plant and plant-based. So even, you know, the vegan students who come in, it's important that they may not need to eat or touch animal proteins, but they need to kind of understand them. And we've joked that over the years, we've had vegans who leave the school now eating animal protein, and people who eat animal proteins leaving completely vegan. So the journey about that intuitive eater comes into play, because people just become very informed about what's best for them and their diets. But certainly, again, our school, we take such a strong advocacy role in terms of that plant-based is really the primary thing that should be on your plate. So there is, so it is a complete program. The other thing we certainly talk about is conversion techniques. So we are not big proponents of refined anything. Whether it's flour or sugar or the like, however, you do need to learn how to cook with it if you're going to go work in a kitchen somewhere. So part of our programming actually then takes the students on a journey of conversion. So how do you start to make a, say, a traditional chocolate chip cookie? And then there are seven variations that you learn how to make using more healthful ingredients in each step of that process. Maybe there's a gluten-free option. Maybe there is a vegan option. Maybe there is, you know, a sugar-free option, whatever that may be. But so we make sure that people understand all ingredients, and then we try to guide our students on the healthful or more healthful choices that they can employ to create kind of those wonderful, delicious dishes.
Mm-hmm. And is it optional? Like, if somebody's vegan and does not want to have to cook meat, can they opt out of it?
They can opt out of it, but what we ask is that they need to still be, you know, they need to learn everything that we're teaching. So in order to graduate, they really do need to know the safety, you know, requirements of handling animal proteins and all of those things. So, but we're never going to make a vegan who's very, very, you know, concerned about it and has, you know, ethical or religious or otherwise, you know, strong convictions about whether they're going to choose animal proteins in their diet or not. But we just say that if you are going to become a chef, you better know about them. You need to be knowledgeable. So,
sure, of course.
Yeah.
And so what does the Natural Gourmet think about the whole gluten-free trend? I mean, you know, there's certainly people that have, you know, had celiac and have been on this gluten-free diet for health reasons for years. But then there's this whole new trend that it's, you know, just cool, or it's let's try it, or they people think it's healthier. What is Natural Gourmet's take on that?
Yes, it's funny. We talk about this a lot, Bhavani, like about kind of gluten-free and what is that, you know, what is it, and is it really a problem? Is it just, you know, poppy? Is it a thing du jour? And where
I mean,
we
I
really
saw a sign by broccoli. I saw a sign in some store by broccoli, gluten-free. It's like, hello, you know, it's like all of a sudden it's now
it's a sales pitch. It's like when Europeans say, why do you Americans call everything organic? It's actually all organic, you know? So, you know, it's funny how we've had to resort to this kind of, you know, the marketing, and that's actually packaging problems, and which could be a whole different kind of conversation. But from a gluten-free trend, what we have discovered is that I think that over the years, you know, there's a lot of reasons why I think people have become gluten, you know, sensitive or intolerant. A small percentage of the population is legitimately celiac, right? So there is, and that's always been in the history, I think, of humanity. But really, I think a lot of the processing techniques of the last kind of, you know, this industrial food century have maybe kind of cut some corners in terms of the natural processing of gluten. Humans can't digest gluten, and it needs to be broken down. And so I think that, you know, when you do self-rising yeast and all these other elements, they can really kind of maybe leave, you know, molecules that haven't been digested, which will upset anyone's kind of digestion and kind of intestinal tract. So where we come out from the school is that we are acknowledging the fact that this is a problem, that people really do have gluten sensitivities and intolerances, and we try to make sure that we are providing the tools to help the chefs in training or the recreational, you know, chef understand that you can have alternatives to gluten and still, you know, lead a rich and sustainable and delicious kind of lifestyle. So, you know, we have added recently kind of gluten-free programming into the school, which we have traditionally never done, just because we are acknowledging the fact that it's out there. And mm-hmm. until we kind of, you know, get a handle back on, you know, less processing, more real traditional approaches to, say, bread making and the like, that this is going to be something that's there. So we want to make sure that our chefs in training and anyone who really does feel that they have sensitivities can learn how to prepare foods that provide good options for them. But it's not going to go away. And I think that there's a lot of research that transcends the school, but we try to incorporate as well in terms of, you know, is it could be like how we harvest wheat. So there's a lot of theories on, you know, the wheat harvesting practices,
right,
and if we use chemicals
right
in that process, do those residual chemicals create intolerances? Is it the lack of breaking down gluten with self-rising yeast things, you know, commercial baking practices that actually are contributing to this intolerance? And or is there something else that we just don't know about yet?
Right.
So whatever
right
it is, the school really, really tries to now acknowledge it and provide mm-hmm. solutions for individuals who have the experience.
Yeah, I'm finding, you know, for myself, when I do my cooking classes, I've been gearing most of them towards gluten-free, too, because I can easily tell people how you can use a gluten pasta if you want instead. But, you know, just to cover more bases so that more people can, you know, participate in the classes. And, you know, it's very easy. It's so easy now to cook gluten-free because there are so many great alternatives. Really makes it great, easy. But one thing I just want to touch on for people, because we are almost out of time, but we didn't even touch on the certificate program. So can you just quickly give a view of what that is, the certificate programs that you have, because that's very different than the chef trainings.
They are. Certificate programs, really briefly, are they're intensives, right? So they are two-week or kind of a duration of evening classes, and it allows people to immerse deeply into some topics. We do one called culinary nutrition, which really does help, you know, a lot of medical professionals take this, actually, where they're trying to learn how to stop prescribing pharmaceuticals, and they want to prescribe kind of better cooking practices to their patients. So they come to learn that connection between kind of that intersection of nutritional education and culinary arts, and bring it together to create kind of nutrient-dense, very healthful meals. And they really deep dive into kind of various topics that will make them more adept in the kitchen at the end of the day of producing that kind of health, more healthful, nutrient-dense type of food and cuisine. We have something which is called food therapy, which is really an honor and a continuation of what our founder, Anne-Marie Colbin, used to do as a private practice, which really it goes deep into the intersection of kind of the relationship of food and food and health and food and healing and all those elements associated with an individual's relationship with food. And these programs, they're, like I said, they're like typically 2 weeks in duration versus 5 months or 11 months if you're in
right.
professional training. And they provide, when you leave, you can actually complement maybe a professional career as an RD or as an RN or as a doctor or a health coach or otherwise. So we are attracting, we sell out as soon as we put them online because people are finding that they're these wonderful additions to their focus. Or if I'm a recreational cook, but I just really want to be healthier, I immerse myself for 2 weeks and come out much more knowledgeable than when I started.
Right. So why don't you share with everyone the website so that people can find it and check it out for themselves.
Great. It's naturalgourmetinstitute.com. And once you get onto the site, you can navigate both through the recreational programming and the professional programming. And there's lots of links within that site to talk about how to contact us if you're interested, and also a calendar of classes. You can learn more about us, see some great videos of our founder, Anne-Marie Colbin. And we're located in Flatiron in New York. So we're on 21st Street. And we would love to see lots of people come in for the fall and hopefully learn more about how they are, how they can live more healthful lives through good natural cooking.
Great. Well, Jonathan, thank you. It's been great. I love your school and everything you're doing there, and I'm so happy that you're there. So thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah,
thank
and
you,
thank
Bhavani,
you for joining
it's
us.
It's a pleasure to be on your show.
Thank you. And everybody out there listening, thank you for joining us. I'll be with you again next week. Have a great rest of the week. Bye for now.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.